Today we have the United States versus Chin. This is a certified case, so the government will go first. Is government ready?
Yes, sir. Chief Judge Erdman, Senior Judge Sentell, honorable members of the court, may it please the court. When an appellant waives a known right at trial, it is extinguished and may not be raised on appeal. This court could not have been any clearer about the effect of a waive all waivable motions provision in a pretrial agreement when it stated those words in United States versus Gladue. It was a concept that was accepted by the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals and reaffirmed recently in 2014 in United States versus Cron as a concept that applies even to a CCA's review of an appellant's case. Inexplicably, however, when faced with a very similar case, identical to United States versus Gladue, in fact, even a stronger case of waiver, in this case, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals inexplicably declined to apply waiver and in so doing committed legal error and must be reversed.
Counsel, I think that you're reading on Gladue too broadly. That was the appellant raising an issue that had been waived, and the appellant didn't waive an unreasonable multiplication of charges issued before the CCA, did he?
Your question is, did the appellant waive it before the CCA?
No, did the appellant raise an unreasonable multiplication of charges issued to the CCA?
No, Your Honor, the appellant
it's not
did.
The same thing at all.
I would say that, I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I would say that Gladue.
Of course you have to disagree, because otherwise you have no argument.
fair enough, Your Honor. I would argue that the plain language of Gladue doesn't distinguish between whether or not an appellant raises it or it's raised by a CCA. Specifically, the language is very clear that says when an appellant waives a known right at trial, it is extinguished. The issue is extinguished and may not be raised on appeal. I think that's further emphasized later in Gladue when this court expressly adopted the analysis from United States versus Lloyd, which is 46 MJ19, that said that when an express waiver or voluntary consent is present, it forecloses even limited inquiry into unreasonable multiplication of charges. And it did not state that only an appellant raising it in an assignment of errors is foreclosed. It said inquiry into those issues is foreclosed.
What about the language in Gladue where we said that if the appellant's pretrial agreement waives all waivable motions, it barred the appellant from asserting those claims on appeal? It's very specifically limited that to the appellant, it appears.
I think it limited... In terms of that language within Gladue, that sentence, if that sentence was the only language in Gladue, I would agree, Your Honor, that that opinion could be read to limit Gladue to that situation. But Gladue went further than that. And in that, because of that specific language where it said that the issue itself is extinguished and may not be raised on appeal. It doesn't say it may not be raised by the appellant, it simply says it may not be raised. And I think that's further supported by this court's opinion in United States versus Campos, where it talks about why an appellate court can review certain issues. And it said, while we review forfeited issues for plain error, we cannot review waived issues at all because a valid waiver leaves no error for us to correct on appeal. And that's cited in the Army Government Appellate Division amicus at United States versus Campos, 67 MJ330. Why that's important is because it's saying that when an issue is waived, when there's an express waiver, a voluntary waiver of a known right at trial, it is a distinct circumstance. And what that does is it extinguishes that issue. There is no longer an issue there. There's no longer an error. And I think that, in conjunction with the language in Gladue, which expressly adopts United States versus Lloyd, should show this court and inform this court that United States versus Gladue was not intended to be limited just to an appellant putting it in an assignment of errors. And that makes sense just under a common sense and logical approach, because what would we be saying if it was just Gladue was only limited and waiver is only limited to an appellant putting it in an assignment of errors?
Should be approved. I mean, this seems precisely the sort of issue that we left open in NERAD.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that what NERAD said was the language.
I'm pretty familiar with what NERAD said.
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
yes, Judge Ryan, as you wrote NERAD, I would expect you are very familiar with the language. But I would distinguish what NERAD was talking about, because NERAD, in looking at the should be approved language, there's a couple points I'd like to make. First off, when looking at disapproving findings, it harkened back to Quiroz and Claxton. Quiroz and Claxton are two very distinguishable cases from this. And I'd like to point to Appellee's argument where he says Appellee's case in all material respects is no different than Quiro's, but there is a very material and significant distinction between Quiro's and this case. In Quiro's, there was no pretrial agreement with a waive all waivable motions. The same was the similar analysis was done in Claxton. It was a guilty plea, but there was no pretrial agreement. There was no waive all waivable motions, and it was an issue that wasn't raised by the appellant at trial. The same was true with Quiro's. So ultimately, what they're talking about there is forfeiture analysis on appeal. And forfeiture and waiver, as this court made clear in United States versus Gladue, are two very distinct concepts, which wasn't true prior to Gladue, as this court noted in its majority opinion in Gladue. Prior to that point, at the time that Claxton and Quiro's were decided, those terms were used interchangeably, waiver and forfeiture, and this court recognized that in Gladue, but made it very clear that waiver and forfeiture are distinct concepts, and waiver extinguishes a right, and it cannot be reviewed on appeal.
Is it your position then that the CCA, it goes to review the court-martial, right? It's performing its Article 66C review, that no matter how blatantly incorrect something is, no matter how obviously charges have been piled on, and I'm not saying that's this case. I'm just saying, taking it to the extreme position, they see specifications that clearly are erroneous. They see all sorts of problems that as long as someone has waived all waivable motions, that they must nonetheless, they are forced to approve the findings and sentence because the appellant waived it, even though they find that they're incorrect in law or fact.
Your Honor, yes, with waiver. A waived issue cannot be reviewed by a CCA now.
And what does 66C mean? I mean, what's their job? They just rubber stamp as long as the person has waived all waivable motions, even if they have not waived appellate review of their case, that the CCA just has to hold its nose and stamp it.
No, Your Honor, and that's not the government.
Sounds like that's what you're saying.
It's not, Your Honor. The government's position is not that a waive all waivable motions precludes appellate review. There are a number of issues, and we could go down a litany of list of issues that a CCA is still going to review in a case. Let's look at this case first. They reviewed the providency of the appellee's plea to larceny. That's an issue that can be reviewed by a CCA.
Now, so what if they had just shut up about unreasonable multiplication of charges, not said a peep about it, and then under the rubric of sentence appropriateness, granted the relief they wanted to grant?
The relief that they granted, Your Honor, in this case was to dismiss specifications and merge them.
I know, but say they, you know, say it's a case that calls out for sentence relief because of unreasonable multiplication of charges. And say that rather than saying, screw waiver, we're going to get into it anyway, and then talking about unreasonable multiplication of charges, they just say, we find the sentence to be inappropriate and do X and bust the BCD and cut the confinement and do whatever. What then?
What then is that would certainly pull this within the rubric of the language that this court stated in United States versus NERAD, that any exercise of Article 66C authority has to be guided by legal principles and not matters of equity. And I would submit to this court that those legal principles that have to bound...
What's more equitable than sentence appropriateness?
In many ways, Your Honor, there isn't anything more equitable.
We can't review it. It's the chancellor's foot, isn't it?
It absolutely is, Your Honor, in that sense.
It's a separate opinion.
What I would say to that, however, is I would expect that if a CCA was going to look at UMC, they would indicate that they were doing that for purposes of UMC.
Well, but what if we say you can't do that? And they say, well, but we think this is unjust, so we're just going to shove it under sentence appropriateness.
And I think, again, that would pull us back to, and that would be an argument before this court if that issue were to come up, that would bring us back to the idea of United States versus NERAD, that even exercise of 66C authority has to be under a legal standard as opposed to equitable principles.
But isn't UMC a legal standard? I mean, isn't that part of your problem? I mean, it is a legal standard.
It is a legal standard, but getting to that, Your Honor, is the question here. And getting to that, you have to get past waiver. And waiver...
But the CCA didn't waive anything. I mean, it's the appellant that waived something. The appellant didn't raise it. The CCA saw it. It's a legal issue. They applied a legal standard, and they disapproved the findings based on a legal standard.
Well, Your Honor, if that was the case.
I don't understand, A, why you think they're bound by the appellant's waiver, or B, given the fact that they didn't change the sentence, why you care in this case.
Your Honor, I'll answer the first part of that, why the CCA was bound by that, and then I'll answer the second part of that is why the government cares, because the government certainly does. The reason why the CCA is bound is because this court's clear language, the government's position is in United States versus Gladue, says that the CCA is bound by that. United States versus Albury, which recognizes, and I think it's important to point out, Article 66C is not some new authority in terms of the language of that has been there for some time. But every time a CCA is reviewing a case pursuant to Article 66C, they don't get to get out of this court's binding precedent by using.
But the problem is, as Chief Judge Berman pointed out to you, it doesn't say anything about the CCA. I'm glad you're here. It says the appellant.
I think it does, Your Honor, and I know we have a respectful disagreement on that point.
The words say what they say.
I agree. The words say what they say, and they say when an appellant waives a known right at trial, the issue is extinguished and may not be raised on appeal. It doesn't say only the appellant may not raise it, and let's take that to its logical conclusion for the common sense and logical approach to that. Because what we would be saying is waiver doesn't even mean waiver. All waiver means is that an appellant can't put it into an assignment of errors.
Going back to the last quote that you said about the issue being extinguished, you have the whole context of that there. Can you read that and the next sentence together?
I will, yes, Your Honor.
I don't have it in front of me, but I think I remember.
And I'll read the paragraph. If you forget to give the context to it, I won't read the citations that are within that paragraph.
No, don't do that.
The granted issue arises out of the failure of military courts to consistently distinguish between terms waiver and forfeiture. Waiver is different from forfeiture. Whereas forfeiture is the failure to make the timely assertion of a right, waiver is the intentional relinquishment or abandonment of a known right. The distinction between the terms is important. If an appellant has forfeited a right by failing to raise it at trial, we review for plain error. When, on the other hand, an appellant intentionally waives a known right at trial, it is extinguished and may not be raised on appeal. And then if you'd like, I can go on to the next
sentence. Read the next sentence, if you would. What is it?
The next sentence is the prohibition against multiplicity is grounded in compliance with the constitutional and statutory restrictions against double jeopardy. The related policy against the unreasonable multiplication of charges.
That really was a very parallel case to this one that we have here. But
that's correct, Senior Judge Sentelle. Gladue is extremely parallel. In fact, I would argue that this was even more a stronger case of waiver because in Gladue, the appellant didn't even discuss on the record multiplicity or UMC.
Where in this case, the attorney actually said, well, we would have made a motion concerning multiplicity.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the Air Force Court found, and neither side has taken issue with this finding, that also would have included a motion for an unreasonable multiplication of charges.
What do you do about the language later in the opinion where it says, appellants express waiver of any waivable motions, waive claims of multiplicity and unreasonable multiplication of charges, and extinguish his rights, to raise those issues on appeal, his right?
I would certainly say that, yes, that language is in the
We're
opinion, Your Honor.
Here about he waived, and then he tried to raise the issues. That was the context. It's completely different in this case.
I would say
unreasonable multiplication of charges and a waiver.
And if that was the case, Your Honor, what we would have then is, again, waiver would never mean waiver, and a service court, if waiver doesn't apply to a service court, that means the issue isn't waived. So not only would a service court have the authority under Article 66C, to review these issues, they would sua sponte have the duty to raise the issues because waiver wouldn't apply to them. And that's why even if this court's view is that Gladue didn't apply to service courts, it certainly should extend it now.
Although the opinion does have the language that Judge Ryan quoted from about his right, there's nothing in the language that says only his right is limited. That was the question that was before the court. They answered that question, but they also had the language you read earlier concerning the extinguishment or extinguishing, whichever is correct, of the right.
That's correct, Your Honor. Extinguishes the issue. And I would say the later language that I discussed earlier with regard to United States versus Lloyd also talks about a CCA's review of the case, not an appellant's right to raise it. It's talking about how an appellant
no
reviews
inquiry
the issue.
Into.
That it an express and voluntary waiver forecloses even limited review of an issue. And the reason why it's important, Judge Ryan, to get to that part of the question in my last couple of minutes before I come back for rebuttal after Pelley's argument, why it's important is because it's an interesting circumstance here because the government is not only arguing for our ability to bargain with appellants and accused for pretrial agreements, but this is also an accused right. One of the reasons why pretrial agreements are actually entered into is to streamline the process and have certainty on appeal, both for the appellant at trial, the accused as he's entered into the pretrial agreement, and the government. And it is a valuable piece that he has, a valuable bargaining chip that an accused has at trial to say, I'll waive these appellate issues. But if waiver only means he can't raise them in an assignment of errors, then waiver doesn't actually exist. There is no concept of waiver anymore, and it guts the concept altogether. And for that reason, then, the government would be forced, going into trial, to litigate issues that were ostensibly waived in a pretrial agreement because there's no legal framework for when a CCA is actually going to decide to exercise this Article 66C power. And if waiver doesn't apply to them, I would say they have to exercise it in every single case. And there is no such thing as waiver. There's no point. The government has no benefit to entering into pretrial agreements because they would have to litigate the issues anyway. And pretrial agreements are a good thing. They're good both for the government and they're good for appellants because they get a benefit of that bargain as well. And it's also good for the appellate system in terms of judicial economy and not clogging the appellate system.
Can you have them waive appellate review?
Not within a pretrial agreement, Your Honor. They can waive it after action. They're allowed to withdraw their case from appellate review, and they're allowed to waive that, and that's their right to do. And if they waive appellate review altogether, a CCA can't review the case. And so if they waive appellate review and a CCA can't review it, then why should a CCA be able to review an issue that they've said, I want to waive that issue? That's less than even waiving altogether appellate review. And so that's why I think it's important. And Chief Judge Durbin, I notice I have about 35 seconds left, if I may briefly conclude.
Conclude, please.
For the reasons I've discussed, because United States versus Gladue is very clear on its face, and also it's important, extending that to the CCAs has important public policy concerns and is good for both appellants and the government. The CCA in this case, when they declined to apply waiver, expressly in contradiction of this court's opinion in United States versus Gladue, they committed legal error, and that opinion must be reversed. Thank you.
We'll now hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Chief Judge Durbin. May it please the Court. I'm Captain Travis Vaughn, and with me today is Captain Michael Schrem. Together, we represent Staff Sergeant Daniel Chin and his appeal as appellee in this case. The question presented by the specified issue...
Could you speak up a little, Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. The question presented by the specified issue is, does a waive all waivable provision in a pretrial agreement strip the power of a Court of Criminal Appeals to exercise its Article 66C should be approved language. This is, at its heart, a statutory interpretation and stare decisis case, but we do not think that Gladue is the controlling law. It is United States versus Narad, United States versus Quiroz, and United States versus Plackton, which govern this case. And that's made especially true because United States versus Gladue comes out in 2009. And I would agree with my distinguished colleague that it does set out the difference between waiver and forfeiture. But that issue is irrelevant to whether a Court of Criminal Appeals can exercise its Article 66C should be approved power.
Well, so what's the effect on the whole system of litigation, which is heavily dependent on pretrial agreements? If waiver isn't waiver, why should the government ever enter into pretrial agreements?
Your Honor, it is waiver as applied to the individual. The individual cannot raise that issue.
Well, but if the thing's going to pop up anyway under the rubric of 66, what incentive is there for the government to enter into this at all?
Your Honor,
I mean, you're going back to a system you had when I was an Air Force JAG, and you didn't have them. They had to be approved by TJAG, which meant there weren't any.
Your Honor, there's still, I would say, a great incentive to enter into these agreements because in most cases, even the majority of cases, waiver is sufficient. What Gladue holds is waiver is sufficient in and of itself for a Court of Criminal Appeals to do no further investigation. Unless there is something clear, there's a clear exaggeration of criminality. And actually, what the Air Force Court in Gladue says, if you go back and look at the CCA's opinion below, they say specifically, the existence of the PTA provision amounts to an express waiver negating the need for a plain error, facially duplicative review. So
Well, they've conflated them. Yeah, okay. Plain error, waiver. Okay, no, they haven't conflated them. They're saying there's no plain error. They're saying they've waived.
They've waived and it's extinguished. Okay. But they go on to say after that, and it erases the need for that review, absent an extreme or unreasonable piling on of charges. So there they recognize, even in the CCA's opinion, Ingledew, that had there been an unreasonable multiplication of charges under the Article 66 power, they still could have reviewed the issue.
Of course, I say there's no such thing, and I blew that horn in Campbell, and nobody answered, so I'm not going to go down that road. But
with all respect, I think even under your analysis in the dissent in NERAD, they would still be able to exercise this power.
Well, my analysis of NERAD was that it was standardless. The majority obviously didn't agree, so.
Factually in NERAD.
I concurred in the result in NERAD. I didn't dissent. Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor, and my apologies.
Yeah.
But what you said is if there were a legal error in the record, that's where the should be approved language should apply. Well, under this court's majority opinion in United States versus NERAD, and that was a case with a waive all waivable motions provision. That case had a waive all waivable motions provision. And the court in that case said they dismissed the charge on an unreasonable, because it unreasonably exaggerated the appellant's criminality and basically an equity ground. And this court remanded to say, if it was unreasonable multiplication of charges, maybe that would have been okay, but not on equity grounds. And in fact, if you go to the oral argument at the time of United States versus NERAD on this court's webpage and you listen at about 8 minutes and 30 seconds, then Judge Baker asked directly to Colonel Weber, could they have exercised their unreasonable multiplication of charges power in this case? And the government in that case said yes. They could have done it on unreasonable multiplication of charges grounds.
What is the standard? It has to be extreme.
No,
I think that's what you just said. What is the standard for blowing by waiver?
It's whether they abused their discretion or not, Your Honor.
Who abused his discretion?
The Court of Criminal Appeals. They have plenary power.
No. What is the standard for the Court of Criminal Appeals to blow by waiver and say, this is so extreme that we're going to do it anyway? It seems to be your standard is it's got to be extreme. But
yes,
that's not much of a standard.
Well, what the court said in United States versus Quiroz is that waiver and forfeiture are left to the sound discretion of the courts of criminal appeals. So they would have to be abusing their discretion, something clearly without regard to a legal standard.
And is there a standard they should apply in exercising that discretion? How do they look at it and decide this is one where we ought to use the 66C awesome power here?
Your Honor, it's the standard that basically sets up unreasonable multiplication of charges in the first place. Do the charges grossly exaggerate?
If that's the case, then you're saying there's no effect to the waiver.
No, Your Honor, not at all.
If it goes back to the same standard that sets it up in the first place, then there's no effect to the waiver.
There is an effect of waiver on the appellant, Your Honor, but as the questions of Judge Ryan asked earlier, the convening authority and the accused cannot contract out of the power of the Court of Criminal Appeals. To do that...
Well, now, is it not the case that they could waive, the accused could waive appealability altogether?
Your Honor, he cannot waive appeal altogether until after action. He couldn't do that as
I'm not asking when he can do it. Is it not the case that he can, in fact, waive appealability?
Your Honor, he can withdraw from appeal. I don't know if he can say he can waive it, but he can withdraw from appeal, which takes away jurisdiction of the Court of Criminal Appeals.
If he can do that and effectively take away the power of the Court of CCA altogether, then why is it not logical that he could do a lesser waiver and waive the appealability of
Your
one
Honor,
issue?
Your Honor, simply because of rule for court martial 1110C, no person may compel, coerce, or induce an accused by promises or clemency or otherwise to waive or withdraw from appellate review. Article 66C.
That doesn't say he can't waive it. It says nobody can coerce him into waiving it.
Yes.
Well, and this court, I don't have a cite for you, Your Honor, but an agreement to waive appellate issues in a pretrial agreement, I believe, would be against public policy.
Well, in a PTA, that's in the PTA reg. But you're not citing that. You're citing something else. You're citing a coercion provision.
I think the point, counsel, is that if they can waive everything at some point in time, right, whether it's via a PTA or not, why couldn't they also waive a review of a more limited subset of the entire case.
Your Honor, because they don't own the Article 66 power.
Well, but they can take it away, right, by saying we don't want you to review our case at all.
On jurisdictional grounds, Your Honor. But I don't think they could say we're waiving it specifically.
Why not? That's what we're all trying to get at is if they can waive the whole thing, the whole 66C power, why can't they waive a part of the 66C power?
Your Honor, because I don't think they hold the power. I think Congress specifically in Article 66.
If they can waive all of it, why can't they waive part of it?
Because Congress.
If they don't own part of the power, they don't own the whole power. They can do. Why is not the lesser child of the greater? Why can't they waive the one issue?
Your Honor, I would say because the Congress didn't give that power to the accused. They gave that power to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And the reason
they gave the power over the whole thing to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And they can withdraw and extinguish jurisdiction there. So why can't they do the subset of it and waive one issue effectively?
I just don't believe they can, Your Honor. I don't have a better argument to say than I cannot find that authority anywhere granted by Congress to the individual.
Is your point that once it gets to the CCA has to do what the statute says?
Yes, Your Honor. They have to do a factual sufficiency review, a legal sufficiency review, and an appropriateness review.
So is there no difference then between forfeiture and waiver?
There is a difference, Your Honor, because on forfeiture, the accused could, as a matter of right, demand relief on appeal, whereas here, the accused cannot demand relief as a matter of right. The Court of Criminal Appeals, I think the Court of Criminal Appeals would have to do a forfeiture waiver analysis and determine whether they had to grant relief or if they could, in their discretion, grant relief.
So the only difference between waiver and forfeiture is the way in which the court gets at it. The same standard of review would apply?
Yes, Your Honor. Well,
what I'm thinking, counsel, if you or I were representing a defendant who somebody else had represented at the plea stage, and he put in the waiver and we knew we couldn't raise the waiver, we can always put it in the statement of the case of the fact. You're going to get it in there.
Yes, Your Honor.
You can call the court's attention to it by other means.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think.
I don't see why there would be any waiver of appealability of an issue left if we follow the course you're asking us to.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the language in United States versus NERAD, United States versus Quiroz, and United States versus Claxton, repeatedly this court has said that a court of criminal appeals has the power to apply forfeiture or waiver in its discretion. It can choose not to if it's exercising its Article 66C should be approved language. It's a unique power, Your Honor, but unreasonable multiplication of charges is a unique creature in and of itself, only limited to military courts of criminal appeal. And as Justuki called out in the legislative history of Article 66 in NERAD, it was to ensure a uniformity of application of the law. In this case, 18 specifications grossly exaggerated the criminality of the accused, and that's what the court found. And they basically reduced that to 11. They only got rid of 7 specifications effectively, 3 dismissed and 4 merged. So it's not like the government didn't get the advantage of its pretrial agreement. The appellee still suffered a conviction. It's just that when he takes that document out in the public world, it's going to look like the government was piling on for an extreme reason, and their purpose is to fix that. Their purpose is to ensure that the law was applied and a standard throughout the Air Force so that an appellant at Kadena Air Base isn't facing 3 charges, an appellant at Grand Forks is facing 18 specifications for the exact same basic course of conduct. And that's where appropriateness comes in, because the Court of Criminal Appeals has given this plenary authority to make sure that there's a consensus or a uniformity in the application of the law across the Air Force Corps.
Well, which is it? Is it appropriateness or is it something else? I mean, I followed what you were saying until the very end, because then you dragged in appropriateness. Aren't you saying that they can blow by waiver if they think it's extreme enough and do what they did here, which is analyze it under the rubrics of UMC, loosey-goosey though they are, and you don't need to get into appropriateness. You know, or I'd go back to my question on the other side, which is, why not? Why don't they just shut up about it and do it under the rubric of appropriateness?
They could have, Your Honor, but in some ways I agree with my opposing counsel is that United States versus Nero says they have to give regard. They have to give regard to the legal standard. So in this case, there were three legal standards they needed to apply. The unreasonable.
Well, they have to give regard to the legal standard if they treat it that way. My hypothetical is they don't say anything about UMC. There isn't any issue. But they think they piled on, and rather than get into all this, they just say, well, the sentence is inappropriate. You know, that wasn't this case. But they just tinker with the sentence under the rubric of appropriateness. That's basically totally insulated from review.
Yes, Your Honor. It's difficult given the plenary power under Article 66C and then the limited review that this court has under 67C to see how you would look at that and say there was legal error there. But in order for there...
You can't look at sentence appropriateness unless it is so gross as to invoke due process. And we don't. But I'm back to my original question is, are you talking about ignoring waiver and going to the merits, or are you somehow dragging in appropriateness?
Your Honor, I think the appellee wins on both analyses, and here's why. Because they had to look at whether there is unreasonable multiplication of charges under the legal standards of Quiroz and Campbell. Then the Air Force Court moved on to say, was there waiver? And they looked at the Gladue, and they analyzed Gladue in the exact way that this court analyzed Gladue and say, waiver would normally stop our analysis. It would normally extinguish the appellant's right to raise the issue. The appellant didn't raise the issue. Sua sponte, the Court of Criminal Appeals, raised that issue, and to see if they had that power, they looked to United States versus Narat, they looked to United States versus Quiroz, and they looked at United States versus Claxton, which all said that they had this power. So they looked and regarded at each of the legal authorities that they needed to, and then applied it using their discretion. The basic question is do they ever have the legal authority to do this? And this court has said repeatedly that they do. And in United States versus NORAD, this court held out as the quintessential exercise of Article 66 power is to not apply forfeiture or waiver, citing DeCuros and Claxton. And that is exactly what the Air Force Court did here, is to exercise its 66 power. After finding waiver, applying the right, and when I say apply waiver, they mean they found waiver. They found that there was waiver. They didn't say that it extinguished their power to do so. And to do that would be a non sequitur, because Gladue says that waiver can extinguish the accused's right to raise the issue. It does not say or require that a court of criminal appeals must apply the waiver doctrine to extinguish any relief, or that a court of criminal appeals cannot grant relief. That is not what Gladue says. It does not say that the court couldn't have granted relief. And the...
Okay, so back to my original question is, assuming the CCA can grant relief, what's the standard?
Your Honor, your standard of review would be abuse of discretion. Their standard for applying it would be, does it grossly exaggerate the criminality of
Well, that's the standard. That's the Quiroz standard. But that's not my question. My question is, what's the standard for getting around an express waiver?
Your Honor, an extreme piling on. That's what the court in Gladue said, is an extreme piling on or an unreasonable multiplication of charges that couldn't be explained on the record. And I think that's what you have
well,
here.
But you're just going back to the basic UMC rubric. And that's fine if the issue is raised and not waived. But here the issue is waived. And my question still is, I would think there'd have to be a higher standard for getting around a waiver than simply the general rubrics of unreasonable multiplication of charges, but that's all you're giving me.
Your Honor, it would be an extreme piling on above the normal. I mean, I guess that would be...
Extreme piling on what?
Above the normal amount that you would find...
Okay, so it's an extreme, extreme amount.
An abnormal extreme.
An abnormally bad multiplication.
That's what the court found in this case. They even cited other cases where they said we would have applied waiver in normal circumstances, and normally that would end our inquiry. But not here, because 18 specifications for what is really one course of conduct and three basic theories of liability should not be made.
So NERAD is now coming back to haunt us, or the majority opinion of NERAD is now coming back to haunt us, because what we have here is a standardless delegation to the CCA. But your contention is that's what Congress did.
Yes, Your Honor. They gave it this plenary de novo power that could act in almost any circumstance.
I mean, counsel, I think what the problem is, I mean, NERAD, of course, is stuck with Claxton and Kuros, right? And 50 years of 600-pound gorillas and awesome plenary powers in the language of Article 66C.
Yes, Your Honor. But
you understand the problem that we're struggling with is, despite all that, and despite the fact I agree with you, Kuros and Claxton and NERAD all say that the CCA can do exactly what it did.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? Problem is, what's the practical import of that in terms of, if waiver doesn't mean waiver, what does it mean?
Your Honor, it does mean waiver as applied to the appellant. And waiver, at the end of the day is a judicial construction, which makes a great amount of sense, and it's under contractual type of theory. But this is a congressional delegation of power given to the court, and I don't see how waiver can eviscerate that congressional delegation of power.
Waiver always eviscerates some power. If waiver has any effect at all, it's eviscerating some power. I don't follow that argument. There can be no waiver if you're correct about that, can there?
Your Honor, there is waiver as applied to the appellant, not as to the Court of Criminal Appeals. That's our contention, is that waiver cannot bind the Court of Criminal Appeals since it has this awesome and strange power that Congress has given it.
Okay, counsel, but in that regard, federal civilian courts have held that, in fact, for instance, D.C. Circuit in United States versus Weathers said that when an error is waived, it's extinguished, and that the appellate courts cannot reach that issue. Now, you're pointing to Article 66C, but under NERAD, you have to have a legal standard. If there is no error, if it's evaporated, how can the CCA apply any type of legal standard?
All right, I see my time is about to...
You can respond.
Your Honor, and the difference I would see there, Your Honor, is that's an Article 3 court, and so... The sort of case and controversy has gone away. This is an Article I court that has expressed powers. They're not equitable, but they are on a reasonable legal ground. And so the court is allowed to go back through the record and say, on the basis of the entire record, were the unreasonable multiplications of charges, was it appropriate at the end of the day? And the court could say no, despite waiver. I think they should have to take it into consideration. And in most circumstances, waiver will be strong evidence that the court should not move forward. But in order to ensure that every accused is being charged in a somewhat normal manner, the courts of criminal appeals have this ability to go back and look at the entire record for appropriateness.
Chief, may I follow up on
that? Please, please.
But my point is, if there is no error anymore, how under Article 66C, as it intersects with our court's decision in NERAD, can there be any legal standard that's being applied if there is no error?
Your Honor, I would disagree with an assumption from the question, is that there is no error. The error is still in the record. It's just that the waiver has evaporated the appellant's ability to raise that issue.
But let me read to you United States versus Weathers, which follows Alano, which is cited in Gladue. The D.C. Circuit said, quote, when an error is waived, it is extinguished. The result is that there is no error at all, and an appellate court is without authority to reverse a conviction on that basis. So my point is, certainly, Article 3 versus Article 1 courts, we're dealing here with 66C, that doesn't apply elsewhere. But based on that concept, number one, it shows it's not a unique concept that would be extinguished. But number two, if we're saying under NERAD, you have to have a legal standard. If there is no error for the CCA to examine, how can we say we're applying any type of legal standard, whether the CCA is?
Your Honor, I think the legal standard you're applying is unreasonable multiplication of charges, and the Article 66C power. I agree, Your Honor, that I don't think any other federal court could do this. I don't think the 11th Circuit, the 5th Circuit, I don't think any of them would have the power to do this. But they also don't have unreasonable multiplication of charges. They could only grant relief on multiplicity, not an unreasonable multiplication of charges in the first place. Unreasonable multiplication of charges, by its very nature, is attached to the should-be-approved power under Article 66C. It would not exist except for the plenary power under Article 66C. There would be no relief under unreasonable multiplication of charges in a normal federal court at all. It could only be for multiplicity or double jeopardy grounds.
At the risk of stretching this out, I'm not sure that's what Judge Olson is saying. Yeah, they don't have UMC, but that the opinion says more. The opinion says, regardless of the subject matter, it's dead. It's extinguished. And that comes from Olano, which we purport to follow. So where are we?
Your Honor, I would just go back to, nothing can erase the errors from the record of trial, and a court of criminal appeals has the ability to assess the entire record and grant relief on that record. And just like in Tardif, even if in and of itself something was factually and legally sufficient and the error in itself could be waived, you could waive speedy trial, but that doesn't mean that a court couldn't grant Tardif relief on Moreno grounds or on delay of trial grounds. And it's the same type of power that's being exercised, just in a sentencing set. But as this court found in Arad, it should be approved by the, both the findings and the sentencing language in article in that second sentence of Article 66C.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel. Does the government have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I'd like to go back to one of the colloquies you had, Chief Judge or Senior Judge Sentell, with Appellee's Counsel about where waiver is provided for, and you asked about the waiver of appellate review. Article 61, paragraph A of the UCMJ specifically provides that an appellant may waive appellate review. The withdrawal of appellate review comes in paragraph B of Article 61 of the UCMJ, so it is statutorily provided for that an appellant may, in fact, waive his entire appellate review, which would deprive the CCA of its jurisdiction. But if appellee's argument is to be accepted by this court, it wouldn't. The service court would be free to revive anything from the dead. I would also go...
No, counsel, that's not true. Because if it didn't go to them, right, if it didn't go to them because the entire case was waived, then they would have no duty to apply Article 66C.
Well, under appellee's argument, Your Honor, I would say that it would have to go to them based upon the 66C authority because it doesn't erase any errors if it's waived. And I would also point the court to, as far as
That's a spurious argument. You realize that?
I respectfully don't think it is, Your Honor, but you're much smarter than I am on that point.
I wouldn't say that. Can I just ask this question?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I mean it really candidly, right? I don't think you can honestly argue that under NIRAD and PIRAS, et cetera, that the CCA, it doesn't say that the CCA can do exactly what they did. I mean, there's language certainly in those opinions that say that they can. So my question for you is, and I'll say you're just agreeing with me for the sake of answering my question.
Fair enough, Your Honor.
How do you get around that?
Well, there are two ways to get around it. First off, if that's the position, and in the hypothetical, I agree with you. The way to get around that is I think this court has to revisit that language from those opinions, particularly with the language in Ledoux.
Of 600-pound gorillas and awesome plenary powers and the language of Article 66C, which says, you know, what do you do with that language? Because it's very broad language.
What you do with that language, Your Honor, is even in NIRAD, the majority of this court, in your opinion, said that it has to be guided by legal principles, and that includes the approach to waiver. There has to be some legal principle, and the mental gymnastics of appellee's argument to try to get around waiver, if it's somehow extremely exaggerated more than the norm, that's applying the UMC analysis to then get
but,
to the UMC
the
analysis.
The language in those cases always recognizes waiver and forfeiture and talks about their discretion in nonetheless deciding whether something should be approved.
Well, what I would say, Your Honor, is that the language from Quiroz just parrots the language from Claxton, so it's really
and
one
a lot
place.
Of it is for the reasons that the appellee's counsel said, right, which is, so if there's some rogue Kadena Air Force Base place where they pile on 3,000 charges instead of three, that there's supposed to be a service court that finds some sort of equipoise between them.
Chief Judge Drummond, I recognize I'm out of time to answer the question.
Please respond.
Judge Ryan, what I would say to that is this. As this court recognized in the United States versus Gladue, it's a distinct situation we're talking about when we actually have an express waiver, which wasn't present in Claxton, wasn't present present in Quiros and wasn't present in NERAD. NERAD was dealing with a CCA who thought that the appellant in that case should not have a conviction for possession of child pornography for a picture of a 17-year-old in the case, even though it met the legal definition under the statute. But in Gladue, this court stated, this case is distinct from the cases relied on by appellant because here appellant's pretrial agreement expressly waived all waivable motions. And that's why, again, this case, appellee's case, is very distinct from any of the language from Quiros and Claxton, which, again, I would say the language in Quiros, if you look at where that language comes in the opinion, it's under a section entitled forfeiture. So it's very clear that they were still interchangeably using those terms until this court made it very clear in Gladue that they were very distinct concepts. And waiver extinguishes the right. It may not be raised on appeal. As Judge Olson, the question Judge Olson was asking about, there is no error. And that's supported by this court's opinion in United States versus Campos, which said that when there is a valid waiver, there is no error to be corrected on appeal. So then you can't have a legal framework to get around waiver. And what I would argue as far as how you read it in conjunction with NERAD, is again, NERAD, I think, was dealing with, as it, when it cited Quiros and Claxton, was dealing with forfeiture cases. But NERAD said there has to be a legal framework. The legal framework, and that's true for any Article 66C review by a service court. The legal framework is provided by the binding precedent from this court as well as the Supreme Court of the United States. And if we're to take Appellee's argument and the Air Force Court's decision in this case at its face and say that was a correct decision, what effectively the Air Force Court has done is added a caveat to every single opinion that's issued by this court. This is the decision of the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, comma, unless the service court believes that it's wrong and doesn't like it and wants to do something else.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a fair characterization of what the CCA did here. I mean, I really don't.
That's fair, Your Honor. That's certainly the way it looks to us, particularly with the way they've used that power in United States versus Jeffers. They also use their Article 66C power in that regard in United States versus Gay, which we cited in our brief. I know that's a pending case before this court. But they have used it beyond just the situation that they did in United States versus Chin. So I don't think we can look at it in a vacuum. I think how it's read in conjunction with NERAD, you have to have a legal framework to get around waiver. The legal framework is provided by United States versus Gladue, which says that a waiver extinguishes the right, and it may not be raised on appeal. And if the CCA does not like the logic of that opinion, because it's very clear, and I know we had a back and forth about what Gladue says, Your Honor, during my initial argument, but this is the government's position in our reading of Gladue. It's very clear, and I think particularly in conjunction with the United States or with Olano in terms of what waiver means, the CCA's recourse was to cite that in an opinion. They could say, this is what we would have done had we been able to get around waiver, but there's no mechanism for us to do so. We would ask the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces to revisit their logic in United States versus Gladue. That's what Albury tells us is the recourse for a CCA. Otherwise, their recourse...
Read it the way that you do as opposed to the way that others might, right? I mean...
Well, Your Honor, what I would say is that if you read the as I know all judges have, the Chin opinion, they don't say that, hey, this doesn't waive it for us. They say that we can just exercise this awesome plenary power. So they don't even provide a legal framework for how they get around the waiver. Their legal framework is the third Quiros prong, which is UMC. They're using UMC.
They go and they cite cases where we've said that they can do exactly what they did here, despite waiver or forfeiture.
They cited to United States versus Quiros and United States versus Claxton, which again was back when the courts were not distinguishing between waiver and forfeiture, and also were not cases that dealt with an express and voluntary waiver by the accused of a known right at trial, which the government's position would be that extinguishes the right, and it may not be raised on appeal. And certainly if this court does not agree with that reading of Gladue, the United States would ask this court to expand that language, because otherwise it would be an untenable position, and for both appellants and the government, there would be no point to pretrial agreements, because there would be no such thing as waiver. Because appellants would be safe to do so, and I imagine they already are, even if they might not be able to, in an assignment of errors, say, this was a UMC, we asked you to reverse for UMC. They say, well, we'll ask you to review it under Article 66C and dismiss these charges for UMC, when the government didn't have the opportunity to actually fight that motion at trial and put on all the facts they may have, which would make PTAs worthless for the government. And I think that's untenable for the military justice system. I notice I'm well over time, Your Honor, so that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Counsel. The case is submitted. The court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.